you'd do bloody well to keep your hands off it. The Balanquin's eyes fell on me, and I cringed. The woman scanned our group of girls. Do you let women work on your ships now? She sounded surprised, pleasantly so. Ah, no. These are our passengers, and as you can imagine, they need assistance out here in these conditions, so your help would...
Oh, now we're your passengers?
Turning from the captain, I faced the Balanquin woman with as much courage as I could. Begging your pardon, mistress, but this lowlife was ready to abandon us to the wolves minutes ago and steal our benefactor's property. I wouldn't trust him either, if I were you. But the rest of us, we're just on our way to Cape Triumph to get married. You tell us the quickest way out of here, whatever you want, and we'll do it. We'll even pay you for passage. I didn't want the sailors absconding with Jasper's goods, but I was pretty sure he wouldn't mind if I bartered away a few things to get us back. I nodded toward the merchants. And, they're with us too. Also, happy to pay, I'm sure. The two Balanquins studied me for what felt like an eternity. I don't think they even blinked. Then, without another word, they rowed back to their companions and began speaking in a language unlike any I'd ever heard. Internally, I wilted, unable to believe the way I'd just spoken to them. But I couldn't leave our fate in the sailors' hands. If I wasn't in Cape Triumph when the Wilsons arrived, I knew they'd take good care of Mary, but they'd also take her with them if they had to leave, to follow their job leads in the southern colonies before I arrived. I could easily lose track of her.
I hope you're happy, growled the captain. You've most likely gotten us all killed.
It's not like you were doing so well, I hissed back. Besides, you're not my responsibility. I studied the riders and noticed that they didn't all seem to be Balanquins. A handful had lighter hair and skin and wore far less elaborate clothing. They looked rough and seasoned, as though the harsh elements didn't faze them at all. But were they Osfridians, or some other people from Avaria? Would they be sympathetic to us? The Balanquin leader separated herself again and returned to us. When she spoke, she directed her words to me.
We've decided to help you. We'll escort you to our outpost southwest of here, down on the Quistimac. You'll be given food and shelter. We can also transport some of your cargo tonight. We'll come back for the rest of it in the morning, at which time we can negotiate a fair price for our assistance.
Her dark brown eyes shifted to the captain.
A price everyone will pay for themselves, with their own means.
The captain sagged with relief.
Certainly. And then from there we'll take you up to the Quistimac, to a ford near Constancy. Your own people can deal with you then. The trip should take about 3 days.
Constancy! Exclaimed Captain Milford. That's a landlocked farm town! If you want us in Gratian, fine, but at least take us to the coast so we can get a ship in Watchful. We don't want to go farther inland.
This isn't negotiable, said the Balanquin man who'd spoken before. Travelling to Watchful passes through too much of our territory and the Ikoris. Neither of us want you there. Going to Constancy keeps you mostly on the river, and gets you back to your own lands faster.
For which we are very, very grateful, I announced. I knew little about Gratiand and nothing about Constancy, but I'd gladly take any of the colonies over a leaking ship or freezing beach. When can we go? The Balanquin woman was watching the captain.
As soon as everyone agrees.
He threw up his hands. Of course we agree. What damn choice do we have? It was fully dark when we reached the Balanquin's trading post, and by then I couldn't feel any of my extremities. Bone-weary, I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, telling myself that each step I took was another step to Mary. The trading post sat on the bank of the Quistimac River, which appeared only as a dark ribbon this time of night. The post's main hub was a simple, one-room rectangular building, though when I passed close to its walls, I noticed fanciful and highly detailed carvings in the wood, similar to the designs in the Balanquin's clothing and gear. I'd learned along the way that our ship had been spotted by a trading party en route to this post, and that they had sought out one of the patrols that guarded the Balanquin side of the river. The merged group of sentries and traders had then intercepted us at the beach. We packed into the post and silently devoured the hard bread and dried meat our hosts provided. The closeness of so many bodies, along with a cozy hearth, provided almost enough heat to make me feel human again. As we finished our meal, Alisi, the Balanquin woman who'd led the party, beckoned me to the side of the room. I rose from the dirt floor on stiff legs and scurried over to her. "Terms in right, correct?" she asked. "You're in charge of these young women." I hesitated and glanced back to where Miss Quincy sat hunched under a blanket. "Yes, I suppose so." "Between them and the others on your ship, we have almost 50 extra people. We can't fit that many in here for the night, but we'll pack in who we can. We have tents everyone else can use, but those too will be crowded. Once my own people are settled, I can give you about 15 spots on the floor, plus a tent. Can you divide your charges appropriately?"
"Yes, of course. Thank you. What about the others from our ship?"
"We've given them tents." A knowing look crossed her face. "But the sailors will not be near you."
"Thank you." I pointed toward the grey-haired Baxters sitting near my friends. "Let that couple sleep in here. Two more from our group will go outside instead."
"It's cold out," a new voice remarked. "You sure your friends won't mind you giving away those spots?"
Alisi and I turned to find we'd been joined by a few of the mysterious riders I'd noted earlier, the ones who weren't Balanquins. The young woman who'd spoken had her hood thrown back, revealing long golden hair in need of a good washing. Most of her needed a good washing, actually. She had dirt smudged on her face and stains on her thick leather coat that my laundress's eye knew weren't ever going to come out. "Honestly, my friends will just be glad to sleep somewhere that isn't in danger of sinking," I told her. "And I'll take one of the outdoor spots, so they can hardly complain over what I'm willing to do myself." The woman rolled her eyes.
"Oh, they'll always find a way to complain. That's the downside of being a leader."
I glanced at the glittering court girls huddled together over their rations. "What's the upside?"
"Still trying to figure that out."
The newcomer turned to Alisi.
"Dermot's burn is starting to bother him again. Can we buy some more nettle from you?"
Alisi looked genuinely dismayed.
"I wish you could, Orla. We send the last batch to Askashi."
"I see. Well, it doesn't look infected yet, so he'll just have to put up with it until we're home. The question now is if we can put up with his grumbling."
"Wait, mistress! What was that? Orla?"
I called as the hardened group started to leave. The golden-haired woman regarded me with impatience. She struck me as someone who didn't handle delays well.
"What kind of burn is it?"
"Sparks flew onto his gloves while he was building a fire," she said after some hesitation. "They took hold and blistered the side of his hand before he could rub the flames out."
"Okay, wait just a moment."
Leaving them puzzled, I hurried out of the post, gritting my teeth at the icy wind that met me. Our cargo was stacked nearby, guarded by a couple of Balanquins who watched me closely but didn't interfere as I searched the pile by torchlight. I wasn't even sure if what I wanted would be here. It could have been left on the beach until morning.
There you are, I murmured, spying a long, flat leather case. I carried it back inside and was intercepted along the way by Polly.
Tamsin, even in here, it's still cold. I mean, it's better, but isn't there something you can do?
She pulled irritably at the edge of her cloak, which was made of a wool that was very lovely and very finely woven, but also very thin.
We didn't come prepared to camp out in the woods for 3 days.
What is it you think I can do? I asked, taken aback by her tone.
I don't know, but you get things done.
I'll see what I can do, I muttered, returning to Orla and Elise.
Here.
Orla stopped their Balanquin conversation and took the small bottle I handed her.
What is it?
Arnica. Not as good as nettle for burns, but it'll take the edge off it.
I know it, said Orla.
She peered at the rest of the box's contents, consisting of various creams, rouges and coal. I had grabbed the whole thing in my haste.
Strange medical kit.
Oh, these are cosmetics. We keep the arnica around for blemishes. I felt idiotic even saying the words. Skin beauty seemed so trite, given our life and death situation. Orla's smirk suggested she was thinking the same thing. She made a comment to her companions in yet another language I didn't know, eliciting laughter. To me, she said,
Well, Dermuk would welcome it,
and maybe he'll even come out looking a little prettier. What will you trade for it?
Food?
I have coin, too.
Nothing. It's a trifle.
Orla's mocking smile vanished first into disbelief, and then suspicion.
You have to take something for it.
I'd hardly charge to ease someone's suffering, not when the remedy is so cheap.
Even someone you know nothing about.
I know he's in pain. That's enough. It's a gift. Take it.
I meant it.
I was happy to help, and besides, Orla and her group didn't really look like they had a lot to spare. I thought they might be hunters or trappers, and I was already building a mental image of them living in some derelict shack in the woods. Or maybe they were hired muscle the Balanquins kept around. Orla wavered, finally accepting when Elise said something to her in Balanquin. Orla thanked me gravely and left with her followers. When they were gone, I asked Elise, I would like to trade with you, though, if you're able. And we'll still pay for the escort, of course. A lot of our clothing isn't warm enough for these conditions, and we could use some hardier things, especially for the journey to Constancy.
We have a few items we brought back from our own expedition. Elise scanned my cohort. And even though your clothing is pretty impractical out here, it would be sought after in other places. You can borrow blankets for tonight, and then we'll see what permanent solutions we can negotiate in the morning.
Thank you. Before leaving, I asked, Who was she?
Orla.
She's not Balanquin.
No. Orla McNamara is one of our Ikori trading partners.
Ikori? I craned my neck, peering at where Orla and her band sat talking and laughing in a corner. The Balanquins had been a hazy enigma back in Asfrid, but the Ikori were regularly described in frightening detail. We had textbooks filled with drawings of snarling, half-naked Ikori wearing tartan capes in gaudy plaid designs. Fantastic stories of their brutal, uncouth and untrustworthy ways ran rampant, and I tried to reconcile those images with the reality before me.
But they're supposed to be, well, shouldn't they at least be wearing tartan and painting their faces blue?
Elise's smile returned.
Too cold for tartan, and woad makes a terrible mess. It's only used for very particular occasions.
Oh.
You look upset.
Not upset. Confused. Orla had been flippant, but her overall air was congenial and polite. Also, she hadn't tried to kill me on sight, as many of our books suggested Ikori regularly did. I just thought Ikori hated our people.
That's often true, but she doesn't hate you. Not yet. Try to make sure it stays that way, and you'll go far around here. Chapter 6.
My tent was so small that those of us who stayed in it pretty much ended up sleeping in a pile that night. But at least that kept us warm. We'd also raided the ship's chests for more clothing, and Elise had made good on lending us blankets. Since the storm 3 days ago, my body and mind had been taxed to their limit, and I slept heavily in those strange conditions, recalling no dreams. But I awoke first, unable to sleep, when I knew there was so much that needed to be done, and that I was the only one who could do it. With a wistful sigh at returning to the cold, I crawled out of my blanket and sat up, trying not to disturb the other girls. Near the tent's entrance, Pamela shifted and opened one eye. I nearly urged her back to sleep, and then, after a moment's thought, beckoned for her to follow me. Outside, the post's other inhabitants were stirring. The Balanquins looked as though they'd been up for a while, and new piles of cargo showed they'd even made a trip back to the beach. Captain Milford stood arguing with a small cluster of Balanquins, led by Harshan, the man who ran the trading post. A crate full of tin cans, not jaspers, stood open between them. "They're going to come to us next to negotiate our fee," I told Pamela. "I want you to be in charge of it."
"Me?"
she squeaked. "Your family had a stand in the West Market. You know how to haggle." She shuddered, watching the Balanquins moving around us.
"Yes, but not with them. They're so odd. Look at the pants on that woman. Can you imagine? And they sort of have the upper hand here. How good a deal can I really get?"
"I think they'll be fair in bargaining, more or less. Alicia and Harshan seem decent, but we are an inconvenience for them. That dinner didn't seem like much, but for 50 people, that's a lot of food they gave up, and we should pay for it. They're going to sell us some travelling clothes, so just see what you can do to get us out of here without giving away all of Jasper's stuff." I tried to recall anything about Balanquin and Osfridian trade. "Silk, start with that. They don't make it here. But stay out of our personal things if you can. Jasper brought clothing specifically to sell. Use that." Pamela pointed at the haphazard collection of boxes and crates.
"How do we know what survived?"
"We don't." A few other sleepy girls emerged from the post, and I summoned them too. "You girls start sorting and organizing the cargo. Find our own belongings and Jasper's trade goods." I set the makeshift committee to inventorying and was surprised they didn't question the order, just as they hadn't while making the beach fire. Everyone felt lost in this new situation, but as long as I kept sounding confident in my directions, they thought I knew what I was doing. It provided reassurance for them, but little for me. I was as adrift here as I'd been on the damaged ship and hoped my decisions would deliver us to a safe haven. By late morning, we had nearly everything in order. We'd decided which of our goods would stay behind and which would go with us to Grashand right away. The Balanquins had limited boats at the trading post, so a handful of sailors were remaining with the cargo that wouldn't fit. The rest of us, along with a dozen Balanquins and the Ikori, would sail west on the Quistimac. Pamela had bartered well, but summoned me to endorse the final deal.
"I know you said not to trade our own glittering court clothes, but the Balanquins saw them and are insisting on some."
I followed her to where Harshan stood near boxes and trunks. Several elaborate ball gowns were draped over a crate, including my favourite, an off-the-shoulder dress of deep green silk, trimmed in silver beads. Jasper allowed us to keep one dress when we married, and this was the one I'd wanted. I sighed, running my chapped hands over the delicate, iridescent fabric. Any argument I might make had already been attempted by Pamela. In fact, she'd already talked Harshan down quite a bit, but for these dresses,
He remained obstinate. As I took stock of the other things the Balanquans wanted, and what we were getting in exchange, transportation, food, and several cloaks of fur and thick wool, I knew it was a good deal in purely monetary terms. But the personal cost of that dress hurt. "Go ahead," I said. Although we'd all heard and agreed to the travel itinerary last night, the full reality of what it meant didn't hit us until we actually walked up to the Quistamack. All eight of the post's boats sat tied at the river's edge, already loaded with our supplies and even a few horses. The flat, rectangular barges had sides about 3 feet high. They looked sturdy and secure, but there was no denying the truth. We would have to sail again. I saw several girls come to an abrupt halt when they realized it, and even my stomach lurched. The day had dawned clear and mild, and sunlight made the Quistamack glitter. Birds sang in the towering trees surrounding it, and a light breeze suggested the weather might even turn warmer. But the river was still a river, and this one, pretty or not, was wide and deep, with a swiftly moving current that we'd have to fight against. "The Balanquans travel this river all the time," I told myself. "They trust those barges. And it's not like we're in the middle of the ocean with no land in sight. The banks are right there." I took a deep breath and continued forward. "Come on, girls, let's be on our way." My confidence wasn't quite as effective this time. A few of my companions stayed rooted and shook their heads, faces drawn. Even one of the merchants blanched. Conscious of the Balanquins' impatience, the braver girls and I fervently made pitches to our terrified friends. We reminded them how fast the trip would be, how close we were to normal Asphridian life again. In the end, we had to forcibly drag only two, and even they stopped resisting once aboard. I clenched my teeth when the lines were loosed, and the rowers took us toward the river's center. The barges bobbed and wobbled, just like any water vessel, and I kept my eyes fixed on the bank. Close. It was close. Hardly any distance at all. I was a decent swimmer, and knew that Damaris, sitting beside me, was an exceptional one. The rowers refused my offers of help, and we moved swiftly, despite the contrary current. I watched the beautiful, rugged terrain go by, and wondered what it would be like for Mary to play in all that space, instead of in a cramped city. In the midst of all the uncertainty in my life right now, I'd had little chance to appreciate the wonder of Adoria, a new, wild, and unexplored world. Although, was it truly unexplored? To Asphridians, perhaps. Most of the land around the river looked untouched at first glance. But on our journey, we passed by another Balanquan trading post, and then later, a cluster of unusual buildings that I was told was a Balanquan town. On the other side of the river, smoke drifted up from farther inside the woods, and I heard someone speak about an Ikori camp there. Thinking of the Ikori reminded me that Orla and her entourage had a spot in my barge. Unease over being on water again had kept me from talking to them, or anyone else. Now, I studied them covertly, still finding it hard to believe they were Ikori. They wore the same nondescript clothing from last night, the leather coats and pants that could have belonged to any rugged Asphridian explorer. They laughed and joked easily with both the Balanquins and Grey Gull sailors. Orla noticed my scrutiny and flashed me a grin. Her face was cleaner than it was last night, but only a little. "Hello there, little leader. How'd you sleep?" "Pretty well, actually. Considering what's happened this week, I think I could have slept anywhere." "I hope you keep feeling that way, because it's just going to get colder as we move inland." I squinted up at the sky, where a pale sun peeped out between layers of drifting white clouds. "Not so bad now." "Sure, but we're still feeling the edge of the boiling current. Nothing like that ahead. Boiling current. Overhearing, a sailor sitting behind Orla explained. It doesn't really boil, but it's not cold like the northerly. Comes from a different part of the ocean, brings warm water. And warm weather, concurred Orla. Go farther north up the coast, and you'll think it's almost summer. I had a hard time imagining that the weather could get warmer going north. Have you been there? I asked her. Often. I always try to schedule my trade trips there for this time of the year. Her smile turned wry. But in Grashant, and where I live, farther west, there's no question winter's still got its hold. I tried not to grimace. That won't make travelling south easy. The young sailor who'd commented before nodded. The roads get rough, and Euros help you if there's a blizzard. Those things come out of nowhere. You won't be able to travel at all. You won't be able to travel at all. I have to, I blurted out. How long does it take to get to Cape Triumph if the roads do stay clear? Orla's eyebrows knit in thought, and she said something to the Ikori beside her in their language. It struck me for the first time that Orla spoke Osfridian perfectly. No trace of an accent. A man answered her, and Orla translated. For a group your size, maybe 6 weeks. 6 weeks, I repeated bleakly. A long time on the road. But not the longest time. Not an impossible time. I'd still have well over a month to secure a marriage before Mary arrived. That should be easy for someone with my exceptional qualifications. And even in the unlikely event I couldn't find a husband right away, I'd still at least be in the city to meet the ship. We'd figure out something. Noting my reaction, Orla asked, "You're anxious to see your betrothed. Don't have one yet. I thought you were all going to Cape Triumph to get married." "We are, but we've got to find husbands first. That's the reason we came over here, to meet and marry respectable men." "Interesting." Orla had another murmured conversation with her seatmates. Seeing my puzzled look, she explained. "I'm trying to decide if I like your situation better than mine. I already have a respectable husband lined up, but I didn't have much say in the choosing. I'm going to meet him in a few weeks." "Congratulations." She shrugged. "We'll see. If I don't like him, I don't have to be around him that much." "He's in Kershid. That's across Denham's west border. Once we're married, I can just visit him now and then. There are plenty of reasons my people would need me to stay up here, and I can make up more." "That's a lot of travel for now and then. Seems like you'd spend half your life on the road." Orla appeared momentarily confused, and then laughed in understanding. "Oh, you're thinking of what I told you about 6 weeks on the road." Now I was lost. What else would I think? "Sorry, I'm forgetting you haven't been here very long. We rarely travel overland to go south. There's a river, the East Sister, that runs through our eastern territories. It angles down close to Denham's border. It's fast, not as smooth as this. But you can be on the west side of Denham in, a week and a half." "A week and a half?" I tried to picture Denham's width on a map. "How long to Cape Triumph? Is there another river?" No. Well, there's the bay, sort of. But most travel through there is by land, and I think that takes a week. Maybe a little more." But, how could no one else see what I could? "That's 3 weeks, not 6. We should just go that way to Cape Triumph." Orla's upbeat expression abruptly darkened. "Ah, well. There are a few problems with that, the main one being that that part of the East Sister is almost entirely in Ikori territory. Your people can't travel on it." "Why not?" One of her companions must have known Osfridian, because he interjected something just then that sparked an Ikori conversation between all of them. Orla nodded at its conclusion and turned her attention back to me. "We've never allowed Osfridians unrestricted access to the East Sister, and because of their recent aggression, we've cut them off from it entirely." Her words came out almost as a growl, and I glanced questioningly at Damaris, who'd been listening quietly. She shook her head, as confused as me. "What aggression?" I asked Orla. "If you don't mind me asking. I'm sorry for my ignorance. I just don't know what's going on." "There's no way you could." Orla stared off across the river, her eyes brilliantly blue in this light. "Over the winter, your people, that is, other Osfridian colonists, have attacked a few of our settlements." "Why?" "No provocation. We attempted a talk once. They denied the attacks and claim we raided some of their land." "Claim?" I asked, noting the word choice. "We haven't." She threw up her hands in disgust. "We have no reason to. We've upheld the treaties." I knew the accusatory tone in her voice wasn't directed specifically at me, but I felt it nonetheless. "I'm sorry, but now I understand why you wouldn't be so open to outsiders on your river. I hope things are sorted out soon." "Not soon enough for your trip, I'm afraid." "Oh yes, I meant, I hope they're sorted out in general, not just for me, for everyone. Your people, my people." I studied the vast shore, noting how the pines this far upriver were weighted with snow, whereas the ones at the coast had only been dusted. The air, though cold, felt pure and refreshing. Even with the oars and light conversation, everything seemed so quiet compared to Osfro, so still and calm. "There's been too much strife. Everyone came to this land for something better. It seems like we're all a lot more likely to get what we want if we work together." Orla's crooked smile was back. "Lovely words, little leader, but not so easy to make happen." "I know." I gazed back at the river, aching with memory. Anger and pride are hard to give up. "Something tells me you weren't thinking of Adoria when you said that." Now I smiled, but I felt no joy. "You're right. I was thinking of a friend. We had a huge fight before I sailed here, and now I don't know when or if I'll see her again." "Who was in the wrong?" "Both of us." "Would she say that?" I thought for a moment. "I think so. Even if she didn't, I'd still apologize. My conscience isn't contingent on someone else's." "I see," was all Orla said, and she spoke little for the rest of the day. But I could feel her eyes on me often, and whenever I looked at her, she appeared to be struggling with some great problem. The journey to Grashand took 3 days, but felt like 3 weeks. After the monotony of the river, we travelled cross-country, and at first seemed to be wandering in the wilderness. The Balanquins and Ikori moved with surety, pleased that the clear weather held. My glittering court companions displayed mixed reactions. Some pushed steadfastly forward, accepting this challenge as an inevitable part of their journey to marriage. Others were less positive. "Ugh, this ratty old thing smells like wood smoke," I overheard Maria say to Joan one day. "I can't believe Tamsin just handed over my best velvet dress for it. Is she trying to sabotage me? I knew she was ruthless, but I never saw this coming." I gritted my teeth. The ratty old thing Maria referred to was a heavy fur cloak we'd bought in the negotiations. I couldn't say if it really did smell like wood smoke, but I would have taken it in an instant, especially when we set out in the chilly early mornings. I still wore the same cloak I'd had on the ship. We'd acquired maybe a dozen pieces of heavy outerwear from the Balanquins, and I'd tried to distribute them thoughtfully. Orla, walking nearby, overheard too, and gave me a look that seemed to repeat her earlier words. "Oh, they'll always find a way to complain. That's the downside of being a leader." Around mid-afternoon, one of the Balanquins announced that we'd crossed the border into Grashand. I glanced around, but found no marker, man-made or natural, that revealed how she'd known. Grashand was a young colony and largely undeveloped, whereas some places like Denham Colony had been started specifically with commerce in mind, Grashand's founders had come here so that they could have a safe place to practice their religion. They called themselves the Heirs of Euros, and though they weren't officially heretics, they also weren't on great terms with the Orthodox Church that formed the cornerstone of Asfridian faith. Eventually, our party reached a packed dirt road that grew wider and showed signs of frequent travel. We began to cover ground more quickly and could see farms, Asfridian-style farms, off in the distance, sending a new energy surging through us all. Some of the girls had been flagging up until that point, needing constant coaxing to keep moving. But the sight of familiar buildings and ways of life changed our outlook. It was a comfort after the upended world we'd lived in for the past week. Our steps quickened, and finally, near evening of the third day, the outskirts of a bona fide village came into view down the road. Pamela and Vanessa hugged each other.
"We're almost there," Pamela exclaimed. "We'll finally be with our own people. They'll keep us safe, and..."
Her words trailed off as a gunshot rang through the air, echoing among the trees and sending birds flying. Our party stumbled to a halt, and the Balanquins rapidly drew their weapons. I was near the back of the group and shouldered my way forward to see what had happened. Out of seemingly nowhere, the road ahead had become blocked by a group of men in dark-coloured clothing, all in shades of grey, brown or blue. Most wore wide-brimmed hats or caps of knitted wool. All of them wielded guns, every single one of which was pointed straight ahead at us, save one. That gun was aimed in the air, held by the man who'd fired it to gain our attention.
"Get out of here," he ordered. "Get out of here before we blast you to the oblivion of Oziel's hell."
Those flanking him nodded and muttered similar sentiments. Orla leaned toward me and murmured, "It looks like we've found your people." Chapter 7.
"Do you understand us?"
one of the other men blocking the road demanded. He swiveled around, seeming unsure where to point his gun among so many targets. He finally settled on Elise.
"You aren't just in Asfridian territory. You're in Grashand, a land sanctified by the Heirs of Euros. We want no part of your unholy ways, so you infidels can go back to wherever you came from."
"Gladly," she replied. She looked almost regal this morning, with her hair pulled up in a cluster of intricate braids and shoulder-length earrings, made of some purple jewel that glittered brightly against her coppery skin. I marvelled at her composure, but then she had the backing of her heavily armed people. They looked to be an even match for the men blocking the road. I didn't know which side would win if it came to a fight, but I was pretty sure my cohort would lose either way.
"But first, we need to return something to you."
Elise glanced over her shoulder, and the ship's captain lumbered forward, several sailors at his side. He made a half-bow to the man who'd spoken.
"Captain Jonas Milford, at your service. Our ship took damage in a storm, and we've come to ask your help."
The grey-clad man regarded the captain with only slightly less disdain than he'd given the Balanquins.
"Ship, are you from Osfrit? We're a long ways from the coast."
"Not so long on the Quistimac," said Elise. "We took them in, and now they're yours." Some of the Grashand men had lowered their guns, but none looked ready to welcome us with open arms. I dashed to the captain's side and faced the heirs. "Please, sirs," I said, using my prettiest glittering court manners. "We'd be ever so grateful if you could let us stay with you while we regroup. We won't trouble you for long, We're going to Cape Triumph and we'll be on our way in no time. Another of their number stepped forward, stern-faced. Actually, they all had stern faces. Between those and their drab clothes, they kind of blurred together. You're just a girl. Why are you travelling alone with these men?
I'm travelling with a group of refined young ladies. I stood on my tiptoes and beckoned the rest of the glittering court to me. We're on our way to be married.
The man who'd fired the first shot scanned my friends, then the sailors. He shook his head and scowled.
How can we bring in so many people?
He and his somber companions huddled together, their conversation hushed, but still audible.
We can't abandon those girls out here, one noted. Their delicate natures wouldn't survive against this wilderness or other threats.
He eyed the sailors and Balanquins askance as he spoke. I found delicate a little ludicrous after surviving a shipwreck and the hurried journey to get here, but I held my tongue. They could think whatever they wanted if it would get us to Cape Triumph.
We can't abandon any of them out here,
one finally declared, his voice grave.
Even the sailors. Euros commands us to show compassion to those who need it.
His companions considered this, and at last they came to a reluctant consensus. The one advocating compassion faced Alisi gravely.
Very well. We'll take them all back. No doubt it will require much reflection and prayer, but to do less would show ingratitude to the angels who grant us mercy every day.
Alisi, restless and maybe bored, picked up her horse's reins.
You can do whatever you want, but we're leaving. Captain, I'll send some of our traders to escort the rest of your men and cargo in a few days. Farewell.
Even I was surprised with the alacrity in which she directed her party to unload our goods and leave them in the road. In Usfrid, I'd been taught that we were superior to everyone else in Adoria, but the Balanquins seemed to regard us as little more than children, badly in need of a babysitter. The Ikori, on foot, followed the Balanquins, but Orla stopped beside me and rested her hand on my shoulder. Good luck, Tamsin. I think your friends will be all right with you as their leader. I studied the heirs of Euros, with their guns and suspicion-filled faces. I feel like we've gone from one storm to another, but thank you. Your regard means a lot. Orla didn't move. After a few moments, she said in a low voice, "When I told you we'd barred your people from the East Sister, I left out some details. Officially, yes, it is off-limits, so long as this conflict remains unresolved. But there are a few Asfridians we've had long-time relations with who have no part in policy. They've been our trusted partners, and even friends since long before these recent attacks."
"Hey!" shouted one of the heirs, noticing Orla. "We told you to get out of here, Ikori!"
She ignored him and remained fixed on me. "The party I'm going south with soon is a large one. Lots of barges and boats. It's not just about meeting my betrothed. It's the first real trade expedition of the season, and that has value for a lot of people doing business in Adoria. We've agreed to let some outsiders accompany us, for a price, of course. Most are Balanquin, but a handful of those rare Asfridian friends have also bought passage. One of them is in Constancy. His name is Jago Robinson. He's purchased a large number of spots on the barges. Enough for your group. If you can find him and convince him to give those up, I'll see to it he's refunded, and you're allowed to purchase them instead. The rest of the space is spoken for, and there's no guarantee of a future trip you'd be allowed on."
"Ikori, I'm talking to you!"
Rattled by the colonists shouting and her startling offer, I stammered out, "Orla, I don't know what to say." Though her overall expression stayed earnest, a smile lit her eyes. "You don't have to say anything, except that you'll remember the name, Jago Robinson. Jacob Robinson, I repeated, a bit floored. Thank you. Thank you so much. She shrugged. Well, don't get too excited. He hasn't agreed yet. Before leaving me, she paused to give the man who'd yelled at her a long, icy look. He opened his mouth to speak again, and then reconsidered, contenting himself with repositioning his gun. Satisfied, Orla bid me farewell, and then jogged off to join the Balanquins, leaving the rest of us alone with our ominous new hosts. They directed us and the rest of the Grey Gull refugees to follow them back to town. The heirs spoke in urgent, hushed tones as we walked. When we reached the heart of Constancy, my tension eased slightly. Although small, it was a real town, a town that evoked comfort and familiarity, despite its plainness. The streets had no cobblestone, and the buildings that lined the square had little embellishment or even distinction from one another. A few had shutters and glass windows, and those that had been painted were white. Signs marked ordinary businesses, a blacksmith, a tailor, a cooper. The town's residents stared at us from doorways and windows. They wore dark colours and drab fabrics like the men on the road had, but at least it was clothing of a familiar style, wool cloaks and dresses, cotton shirts and trousers. The heirs split us apart, taking the sailors one way, the merchants another, and then directing my party into the square's largest building, a church. "You may rest in here while the council convenes and decides what to do with you," one of the men said. "Thank you," I said, "and I'm happy to talk to this council and answer any questions that might help." "You will provide the most help by praying," came the curt reply. As soon as he and his companions left, I slumped against the wall. "Looks like it's time for our next strange adventure."
"Well, we're safe now. That's all that matters," Pamela said.
When I didn't answer, she tilted her head to better meet my eyes.
"We are safe now, aren't we?"
"Yes, of course," I said, wondering if I lied. The Balanquins and Ikori had given us a better welcome in some ways, at least keeping us informed of their plans for us. But Constancy hadn't turned us away, and despite their unusual religious practices, the heirs were still technically our own countrymen. Restless, I paced the building, which resembled no church I'd ever been in. I'd heard the heirs maintained a strict and simple lifestyle, but hadn't expected this. Even our humble district church back in Ospro, which had always seemed so dull compared to the city's grander cathedrals, had more adornment. Here, the pine-planked walls wore only varnish and contained no art of any kind. The small, high windows that lined the room's sides contained clear glass, not stained, and were solely utilitarian. There was no altar, no incense, no gold or even brass candle holders. A simple wooden podium appeared to be where the priest would stand, and the congregation sat on narrow wooden benches that lacked even the threadbare pads of our pews back home. An alcove in the back, far behind the benches, contained several shelves filled with books, papers, and other scholarly materials. I knelt on the hard floor to read the book's spines, all religious in nature. Most were copies of the usual holy texts. A few looked to be specific to the heir's faith. Winifred joined me. "Kind of a gloomy place to glorify Euros and the angels. I guess that's their way, though." I thought back to some of our history lessons. They left Ospro because they were always getting into disputes with the priests over excess. "Left? Or were they kicked out?" she asked pointedly. "I suppose it depends on who you ask. I remember Master Bricker saying the king authorized this colony more to get them out of his hair than to approve of their beliefs." "Listen to us," she said with a laugh. "Me from the bridge district, you from the market, talking politics and history like fine folks. But then, I suppose, this is what it's all been for. Not quite, I thought. We were supposed to have improved upon our education in order to rise from our backgrounds and find better lives. Analyzing the practices of a group that barely escaped being called heretics, one we now depended on for survival, had never come up. After about an hour, three women entered with large bundles in their arms. Finally. We gathered around the newcomers, eager for an update. These women of Constancy were clad in simple, high-necked cotton dresses in shades of navy or grey, with heavy woolen cloaks. The oldest of them wore a bonnet, while the others, a little older than me, wore kerchiefs. "You will change out of your clothes and put these on," the older woman informed us. "We are glad to care for you. It's our duty by Euros, but you'll have to abide by our customs while you're here." "Yes, of course," I said, "and we're ever so grateful. We're happy to do whatever it takes to make this easier for you, so we can be on our way." The woman didn't return my smile, and simply began handing out the garments, which were the same type as theirs. They had a wide range of sizes, and it took some doing to sort out what would fit whom the best. The dress I ended up with was navy blue and seemed to be exactly my size, which was a stroke of luck. Some of the other girls were baggy or too long. "It'll have to be let down," one of the younger Greshand women told me, kneeling to examine my hem. "Luckily, there's about an inch there." The length looked perfect to me, but it didn't graze the tops of my shoes the way hers did. "Certainly, if you say so. But if you'll help me understand, is this length, indecent?" "No," she said, with a small chuckle. "But it shows too much of the shoe and stocking. Someone poor may have worn out shoes, or perhaps they can't afford stockings at all. Long skirts and pants make it less obvious. Then those people needn't feel insecure or jealous of others, and those who have more can't easily lord it over the less fortunate." "Ah, I see. Well, if you can lend me a needle and thread, I'll take care of it." "Can you?" She looked pleasantly surprised. "You all look like ladies who are used to being waited on." I took in my party's bedraggled state as I tied a kerchief over my hair. "Well, thank you, I think. But believe me, we've done plenty of waiting on others in our time." I fastened the grey cloak she gave me with a plain pin. The wool was coarse and lacked the embroidery of my previous cloak, but it was so much warmer that I made the exchange without hesitation. Inner pockets held matching mittens. The young woman shook out my old overdress before folding it and exclaimed in delight, "Oh, look at that!" She ran her fingers over the fabric, a pale green cotton scattered with white lilies. Mud from our overland trek had stained the hem, and seawater had splattered parts of the skirt white with salt. "What a shame it's ruined." "There's a trick I know that'll get that mud out," I said. "Take some soaking and a bit of time, but I can do it. If you could get me lye and..." "You have much bigger things to worry about than a gaudy garment." The older woman stomped up and snatched the dress away, adding it to a pile in her arms. "Euros has spared your lives. The sacrifice of this frivolity doesn't even begin to repay that debt. You should be on your knees in gratitude. If you'd arrived earlier, you'd have been in time for our holy day services." "Ah, how unfortunate. But I'll, be sure and get to that kneeling soon. First, I was wondering if you could tell me what's going to happen to us. You see, we're very anxious to get to Cape Triumph, and the council will decide what's to be done with you, and that decision will come when it comes. If you have trouble accepting that, I'd advise adding a plea for patience to your prayer list." She swept away, and the woman who'd helped me scurried after her. They made their way to the third woman, who was kneeling by Polly's ankle and wrapping it. Polly had tripped over a branch earlier that day and been in some pain. As I watched, Vanessa leaned toward me. "Did you know? She's a doctor, that woman. A real, honest-to-goodness doctor.
What?
Are you sure? Female doctors were unheard of in Usfrid. I found it hard to believe there'd be one here when the heirs were rumored to treat women very strictly.
That's what she told me when I was over there, said Vanessa. She said all the doctors here are women. Something about healing being a woman's domain.
Desperately curious, I headed toward the doctor, but she finished her work just then and departed with her two companions. That left us alone once more, and another hour passed before a middle-aged man, with hair cut bluntly to his chin, entered wordlessly and set down a basket of rye bread. He returned again briefly to deliver a barrel of water and a dipper. Our attempts to question him were ignored. The sky had darkened to deep purple when another man entered. He paused to stomp snow from his boots and then took off a wide-brimmed black hat as he surveyed us. Vanessa, still near me, straightened up and murmured,
"My goodness, maybe there's hope for this place after all. Wish I wasn't wearing this frumpy old rag."
Compared to the other townsfolk's grim air, this young man was like the sun bursting into our room. Dark gold hair framed a clean-cut face that had wide-set bluish-grey eyes and the warmest, most sincere smile I'd seen since entering Constancy. That smile looked almost surreal after all the scowls we'd received so far. He wasn't much older than us either, and took a minute to study each face with genuine concern. We studied him, too, some more blatantly than others. He seemed a little self-conscious at our attention, and Vanessa whispered to me,
"Is he blushing? He is! 6, it's adorable!"
I would have elbowed her, except she was right. Clasping his hands in front of him, he cleared his throat and, despite being flustered, spoke with the clear, loud voice of someone used to addressing large crowds.
"Hello, and welcome. I'm so glad you're here. In Constancy, that is. Not just the church. But I'm glad you're here, too. I'm Gideon Stewart, one of the junior ministers. From what I've heard about the dangers you've faced, the 6 must love you to save you from those dangers, I mean. Not put you through them. Anyway, I know you must all be tired and worried, but please be patient with us just a little bit longer. We're going to do our very best to take care of you."
He spoke those last words with such heartfelt feeling that it was impossible not to believe them. Smiles bloomed throughout the church. Maybe things really were going to be okay.
"Could I speak to whoever's in charge of you?" he asked. "Your chaperone?"
We all turned to Miss Quincy, who returned our gazes indifferently. When she shook her head and maintained her customary silence, I stepped forward.
"I'll be happy to help you, Father."
He turned that smile on me full force, and its radiance nearly knocked me over.
"Oh, no, not Father. Only Euros deserves that title. You can call me Mr. Stewart when we're formal, Gideon when we're not."
He led me to the alcove in the back of the church, and a few of the other girls looked as though they now wished they'd volunteered to be the unofficial leader. Maybe there was an upside to this role, after all. I'd have to tell Orla, if I ever saw her again. He dragged 2 benches over and beckoned me to one while he took the other.
"Now then," he said, resting paper and a small lap desk on his knees. "I was hoping to get the names of everyone in your party, their ages, families, that sort of thing. Can you do it?"
"Certainly." I could tell him that, along with probably a dozen or so of each girl's little idiosyncrasies.
"I suppose I should know your name first."
"Tamsin Wright, Miss... begging your pardon. Is this formal or not?"
"Let's say not. Gideon is fine. How old are you, Miss Wright? Tamsin?"
20.
"From?"
"Osfro, Market District."
Gideon's pen paused as he looked up.
"The Market District?"
"Yes."
"Is there a problem?" of course not.
He copied down the information, his writing neat and precise.
And what's your family's occupation?
My father's a day labourer, and my mother's a laundress. I work